What would you do this week if you turned on your computer and went to your favorite news site? Or you picked up the morning newspaper. I don't know if there's anyone left in this country who does that. But you picked up the paper they used to throw on your front yard. And you opened it, and there was the front page banner headline. The United States of America is overpopulated. And in that article, there was listed the planks of a plan that the president has come up with wherein we must get rid of some Americans. How would you feel if the plan involved a national lottery? Every person, man, woman, and child in this country is required to write their name on a piece of paper, or really probably in the computer age, to submit your social security number. And then in a guaranteed, impartial way, the computer in Washington, D.C. will crunch those social security numbers and spit one out, and whatever one or numerous ones were spit out, they would have to travel to Washington, D.C. and die. And that is how the United States of America will deal with their overpopulation problem. How would that make you feel? Angry? Incensed? What is going on in my country? Well, the first year I was here, I mentioned the short story called The Lottery. And in that story, there is that basic plot of a people who had to deal with social problems, and so they came up with a lottery, and those who won or got to die. I bring that up again this morning because in reading about it and bringing it to your attention some time ago, I happened across a college professor who had taught that story in her English literature class for over 20 years. And she, in the article I was reading, expressed her dismay that at the beginning of her teaching, when the students read that story, they were shocked. But now, in the 21st century, the modern student reads the story and their class discussions go like this. Well, you know, I guess I can see how that would work in some societies and in some cultures, you know. We can't really condemn that practice. Who knows? Maybe someday. And so the talk goes. That professor was shocked at the way morality had become relative. And that modern American students, at least in her college and in her tenure, had just blown away the idea of things are definitely right or definitely wrong. We call it the slippery slope of morality and what is happening in our country. In Ruth chapter 3, we have to deal with this idea that is found in verse 11, where Boaz says, "And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest. For all the city of my people doth know that thou art a virtuous woman." We have to deal with the idea of virtue. And I have to, at the beginning of this sermon, plead with you to believe that there is such a thing. That it is not relative. That in spite of what you might hear in colleges, universities, and on television, and on the internet, there are some things that don't change. We, as Christians, have always believed that there are certain absolutes and that those are found in the revelation that the God of the universe has given us. And that revelation, we believe at Faith Bible Church, of course, is the Bible, the Old and the New Testaments. Do you believe in verse 11 that there is still such a thing as a virtuous woman? You know, Ruth chapter 3, I think we can break down into three simple scenes. The first is a conversation that hatches a plan. That would be verses 1 to 5. It's a conversation because if you look at your Bible in verse 1, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her. It's a conversation because you see in verse 5 that Ruth responds. And she said unto her, "All that you tell me to do,
I'm going to do. It's a conversation that hatches a plan. That plan, of course, is enacted in verses 6 to 15. You could describe verses 6 to 15 as a plan that hatches a conversation, because she goes in verse 6, she goes down to the floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. So Boaz goes down, and then he is frightened in verse 9. He says, "Who are you?" And then this conversation takes place where Boaz ensures her that he will do what he can. And then finally, in the last section of the chapter, you have waiting and working. To wait. Look at verse 18. Naomi says, "Sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall." To wait. One works. Verse 18, the man will not be in rest until he has finished the thing this day. I mean, they're going to sit there, but it won't be too long, because that Boaz is just tearing Bethlehem up. He sent a messenger out to that kinsman. He wants to meet in the gate. He's going to get this thing done that day. To wait, one works, but not for long. So that's sort of the simple breakdown of the passage. But I want to go back for a moment in describing this narrative to the second section, the plan that hatches a conversation. I just want to clear away some details from what's happening here. I want you to take note of a couple things about verses 6 to 15. First thing I want you to note here is that there is nothing immoral happening here. There have been recent people, I think read a sermon on this passage, where the man was preaching about immorality taking place the night that Ruth lay at Boaz's feet. That is pathetic. That is reading MTV back into Ruth chapter 3. I mean, look down at the passage here. Verse 6, she goes to the floor. She does what her mother-in-law says. In verse 7, by the way, it does not demand that Boaz was literally drunk. It is possible that he was a little more than merry, but the text does not demand that he was literally drunk. He was joyful. It was the season of harvest, verse 7. He goes and lies down at the end of the heap of corn. And she came softly and uncovered his feet. So it comes to pass, verse 8, at midnight, that he was afraid. What does he do? He looks at her, he sees that a woman is lying at his feet, and he just says, "Who are you?" She responds by identifying herself as Ruth, and then she makes her plea in verse 9, "Spread therefore thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman." His response in verse 10 is key here. He pronounces a blessing on her. Now, us, when we read what Ruth says, we're puzzled. What could she mean? "Spread thy skirt over thine handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman." However, of course, the original readers of this story would not be puzzled. They would know that it has to do with the kinsman redeemer. And evidently, Boaz knew exactly what she was talking about. Because he says in verse 10, first he blesses her. He says, you've been very kind in the latter end, more than at the beginning, inasmuch as thou followest not young men, neither poor nor rich. Verse 11, "And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou requirest." Well, she didn't really require anything. She didn't give the details. She only made a simple request. But he knew the details, and he says, "We know you're a virtuous woman." In verse 12, "And now it's true, I am thy near kinsman. Howbeit, there's one more, so you wait here until the morning, and I will go and take care of this." The rest of the night, she is at his feet. He is probably an older man. Now, we can speculate whether he was psyched up and he could not sleep because he knows he's about to get a wife tomorrow, hopefully. Or we could guess that maybe he was exhausted, it was the day of harvest, and he's just passed out in utter weariness. But there's nothing sexual that goes on here. Matter of fact, it is very important, because if you look here in verse 14, he doesn't want it to be known that a woman even came there. Now, folks, what would have happened to Ruth if it got out that she had been there and spent the night with Boaz? What kind of name would this Moabite woman have? There she goes. I wonder if that woman's for sale. What would her reputation have become? He wants to protect her reputation as a potential wife. And so he gives her food, verse 15. He sends her on her way. And Naomi asks what happened. So I think it's very clear that this is nothing untoward happening between these two people at the threshing floor. It's not a roll in the hay. It's just she laid there. Now that begs the question, so what in the world, why would she even do that? And frankly, from what I've read of the commentators, nobody is quite sure. There's no other precedent for this in the Old Testament, of someone actually going and laying at the feet of someone. I mean, when you get right down to it, Ruth is proposing marriage to Boaz. Would you want your daughter doing that? Probably not. But in this unique situation, that is, in essence, what she is doing. And Boaz understood the expression, "Put your skirt over me." He understood what she meant. So whatever method she used, which is puzzling to us as modern readers, it was not puzzling to Boaz. He knew what was taking place. This is in contrast to Esther. Esther became a concubine. She spent the night with the king, and this is not what took place. Ruth and Esther stand in contrast to one another in this way. So let's hurry on now through the narrative. We already talked about the three sections here, about the conversation that hatched a plan, and the plan that hatched a conversation, and then the waiting and the working. What kind of observations can we make here? Well, I want you to look at chapter 2, verse 23. Let's talk about the time element here. It says in verse 23 that Ruth, she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of barley harvest and of wheat harvest. Now, this next clause, and dwelt with her mother-in-law, it's a little ambiguous, but it seems to indicate that she took her stuff. She had her larder full, and she was now living with her mother-in-law, living off of that food for an extended period of time. We don't know how long, but it seems that in chapter 3, verse 1, that enough time had passed where Naomi is scratching her head going, "I've got to do something." She's no longer out there with Boaz. He doesn't have any contact with her whatsoever. She's here with me. We're living off this food. "My daughter," verse 1, "shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee?" I mean, she wants to do something for Ruth. She's concerned. I want to point out to you what I did last week in chapter 2, verse 1. The writer wants us to know that Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. You and I, as the reader, find that out before Ruth does. But Naomi already knew. So the writer interjects that little hint in chapter 2, verse 1, to stimulate our curiosity and to get us wondering about what will happen. Because right away, Ruth is in the field with Boaz. But Ruth does not know who he is. But Naomi knows. Now, it is interesting to me, and I just say this by way of observation, that Naomi did not immediately command Ruth in chapter 2, verse 2, to go out. "Oh, by the way, Ruth, I have a kinsman. His name is Boaz. Go there. Glean in his fields." The silence there is a little deafening. It really seems like she was hesitant to put Ruth forward to Boaz. So in chapter 2, verse 2, Ruth just says, "Let me go to the field and glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace." I mean, she just goes out and looks for a friendly face. I mean, she's wondering, does it look like I, as a Moabitess, can slip in here and glean? And so we end up in chapter 3, verse 1, suddenly, it has all come to a point in Naomi's mind where she feels like being proactive. You can't get much more proactive in saying, okay, Ruth, I want you to go lay down at the guy's feet and propose marriage to him. I mean, what made the change? Have you ever wondered? She doesn't even tell Ruth about Boaz. Well, I really do want to point out the providence of God again from this passage. Naomi has watched the kindness of Boaz to Ruth, the food that Ruth has brought home, the way Boaz has allowed Ruth to sit at his table and eat and drink. She has seen this for some time. How much time? Well, verse 23 of chapter 2, the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. She's now sitting at home for some undisclosed period of time, looking at this stockpiled food and scheming. And so she gives Ruth the plan. Now, Naomi acted on the basis of what was a clear law, the law of the kinsman redeemer. Now, I've given you a lot of facts. That tends to shut us down. It's hot in here. Turn very quickly to Deuteronomy 25. Try to hang in there. Deuteronomy 25. The kinsman redeemer in the Old Testament, believe it or not, had multiple functions, not just one. Apparently, the kinsman redeemer, his function in ancient society was well known and we could say cross-cultural. In other words, it wasn't a function that was just limited to Israel. There were other cultures of the time who had someone who functioned like a kinsman redeemer. Let me just give you three functions, and then we'll end on the fourth one, that of the marriage that Boaz is going to take. In Leviticus 25:25, the kinsman redeemer redeems the property that one of his relatives had to sell. In other words, one of the functions of a kinsman redeemer is if my brother lost all his property, I could come in and just buy it on his behalf and in his name and get that back to my relative or my brother. In Leviticus 25:47-49, the kinsman redeemer is probably the one who buys back a relative from slavery. So if you have a series of bad harvests and you lose everything and you literally sell your children or yourself, you make yourself a bondman for 7 years. Sometime in the course of your service, that kinsman redeemer can come in and say, you know what, I'm going to buy you out of this situation as your relative. This is interesting. In Numbers 35:19, the kinsman redeemer is probably the one who is the avenger of blood. You go out to the fields to work one day, your neighbor comes up and knocks you over the head to steal your plow, and you die. Well, the kinsman redeemer is the one who's going to go after that guy and be the avenger of blood. And that brings us then to Deuteronomy 25:5-10. So what is the kinsman redeemer in the book of Ruth? Well, let's just read this together. Start at verse 5. If brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of an husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead. So it was a sacrifice. Your firstborn son would end up being heir to your brother's wealth. Look at verse 6 again. That his name be not put out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders and say, can you imagine going and doing this, ladies? My husband's brother refuses to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him. And if he stand to it, in other words, if he says, and I will not take her. Verse 9, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be unto that man that will not build up his brother's house. So there was this public curse And you imagine doing this, spitting into this individual's face. Now, what if you already had a wife? It does not seem to indicate that you are obligated to take a second wife. Boaz had no wife. There's nothing in the story that indicates that he did, which is a little unusual because he was a man of means, and in that time, you could. Some took more than one wife. That's obvious from the Old Testament. Was that God's perfect way? No. All the way back to the Garden of Eden, it was one man, one woman. Into the New Testament, it's one man, one woman. But there are exceptions if you already have a wife. So, now, hang in there. Where does this get us? Turn back to Ruth 3. This will make things clearer when we get to Ruth 4 and we see this guy who doesn't want to be the kinsman redeemer. But the idea of the kinsman redeemer is all through Ruth. Let me just read you a quote. I had a teacher in Bible college. You're not going to believe this. His name was Dr. Wisdom. That was his real name. I remember going to his office one day and looking at that and going, "This is, you've got to be kidding me." But no, that was his name, Dr. Wisdom. He was a great man, a servant of the Lord, just a wonderful fella. I don't even know if he's still alive, but I really loved him. He's a great guy. He wrote this about the kinsman redeemer. He says, "The root of the word for kinsman redeemer appears 23 times in Ruth." Now, that's a lot when you consider, in contrast, the word for love appears only one time in this love story. And on that one occasion, the word is connected contextually to the work of the kinsman redeemer. The author of Ruth really emphasizes the whole idea here of the kinsman redeemer. Now, that brings me then to this. This is actually a third observation. Hang in there. Ruth. Let's get back to the idea of virtue. Talked about the lottery and how hard it is to even believe in something like virtue anymore. If you look at your Bible, she had a lot. Back in Ruth chapter 3, she had a lot going against her. I want you to think for a second what it would be like if you had been in this situation. The Moabites, that was her family. Now, the origin of the Moabites was horrible. Of course, it was the story of Lot and his daughters. How would you feel if you were from a tribe of people that began with the incestuous relationship of a man and his two daughters? How would that make you feel for your family pride? Everyone knows it. I mean, imagine belonging to a group of people living in the United States of America, and you are known as for that. But not only that, and that story, of course, is in Genesis 19, 30 to 37. But imagine that after the Moabites grow and expand, they become quite a force there in Palestine. The Jews come in after their wilderness wanderings. And imagine the king of the Moabites hiring this guy Balaam to curse the Israelites. So Ruth is living in Bethlehem, which is populated by people who know that her ancient king tried to curse them. You know how the story goes. Balaam evidently had some kind of connection with God because God did prophesy through his lips. But instead of a curse, what happened? He pronounced a blessing on the Israelites. But he still wanted that money. He loved money, so he hopped on his donkey, and as the story goes in the Old Testament, he's headed out to make some more money somehow. The donkey is walking along and sees an angel in the distance. The donkey sits down and stops. The guy pulls out his whip or whatever and starts pounding on that donkey. And the donkey opens his mouth and says, "What are you doing?" Now, if that happened to me, I probably would have fallen off the donkey, rolled into the gutter and scratched my head. But Balaam just talks right back to the donkey. And the donkey, of course, saved his life. So there was Balaam and his donkey and Balak the king. That's in Numbers 22, 1-4. But it only gets worse because the curse didn't work. He couldn't curse him, so he comes up with some good ideas. He says, "Look, here's what we'll do.
We'll just get them to intermarry with us, and we'll dilute their religion. We'll cause their young men to fall into the snare of what, of course, they didn't consider it a snare, but their beliefs, and we'll assimilate them. And that, it says in Numbers 25:1, that the children of Israel committed whoredoms with the daughters of Moab. So, what did that do? Well, in Deuteronomy 23:3, the Lord pronounces His curse where He says that a Moabite cannot enter into the camp of the Israelites for 10 generations. I mentioned last week that Ruth was a proselyte, a true believer in the Lord, so she was allowed in. But I'm bringing this all up because she had all of this against her. Seriously, how would you like that? You know, what would your potential for marriage be? Picture this. Say, ladies, the boy who's going to marry you knocks on your door. This is the first time he's met you. It's a blind date. And your dad says, you know, son, come on in. It's a tense situation, a little awkward. He sits down on the sofa. The daughter sits over here in a chair. The father says, now, son, there's a couple things you need to know before we get started in this relationship. One, you don't know this, or maybe you remember this, but years ago, my pappy cursed your pappy. He went out in the hillside. He cursed him and cussed him. And then after that, he tried to get him to commit immorality with ladies in the town. I just want you to know this. And I also want you to know that years ago, I want you to know how our family got started. And then he tells them. Ladies, how would you kind of melt into the sofa? I think I would. That is realistic. I mean, she's living there in Bethlehem. That is their opinion of her and her people. I want to bring that up because she has a lot to overcome with her virtue. It is her virtue and her loyalty that overcomes a terrible, terrible family background. And you could be here today as a young lady and come out of a horrible family. Folks, do you know the last statistic I heard about abuse? Physical or sexual abuse. 2 out of 5 young ladies go through that in this country right now. I don't know how accurate that is, but I'm pretty careful with where I get my statistics. That means I could be looking at ladies today and your family has given you boatloads of baggage to carry out into life. And you could be like Ruth. What chance do I have? I mean, look at my dad, look at my mom, look at my aunts and cousins and brothers, and goodness, even the pets in our house tried to kill each other. I mean, whatever your background is, what hope do you have? You have hope. Ruth was able to overcome by her integrity, by going out into life and being a person of virtue. And someone says, well, Dan, what does that mean? And of course, I have to direct you to Proverbs 31. Turn there real quick. Proverbs 31. What is a virtuous woman? Well, you've probably heard about 10 gazillion messages on Mother's Day about a virtuous woman. And I don't want to beat ladies over the head with this. I want you to be encouraged. In my opening illustration, morality changed. It was a slippery slope. In the Bible, it is simple. Every time you open Proverbs 31, it will say the same thing. It will give you a bar to aim for. What is virtue? In Proverbs 31, 11 to 12. I'm not going to read the whole passage. I'm just going to point out some things. The virtuous woman, first of all, is just a hard worker. She has a good work ethic. In Proverbs 31, 13, for example, she seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. In verses 18 and 19, she perceiveth that her merchandise is good, her candle goeth not out by night. She layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. She works hard. How does she work? Well, she works hard at clothing for her household. The culture of that day involved sometimes making it. Thankfully, today we can go out to the mall and buy it. But back then, she worked hard at that. She also worked hard at feeding her household. Look at verses 14 to 16. She is like the merchant's ships. She bringeth her food from afar. She riseth also while it is yet night and giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. She works hard. Secondly, the virtuous woman is loyal. Boy, is it hard to find someone like this in our culture today. Look at verses 11 and 12. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he hath no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She is trustworthy and loyal to her husband. When she's late, he doesn't wonder if she's off with some man or maxing out the third credit card. And she does that because of this loyalty she has to her family. Her heart, the heart of her husband does safely trust in her. Let me just give you three more. Third, she's generous. Look at verse 20. She stretches out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. She's aware of those that are out there that have needs. And as she is able, she reaches out to those that are needy. She's generous. Fourth, she's wise. Look at verse 16. She considereth a field and buyeth it. With the fruit of her hand, she planteth a vineyard. Look at verse 24. She maketh fine linen and sells it and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. It's not what you think it is. Okay. Also, look at verse 26. She openeth her mouth with wisdom. And then that brings me to the last characteristic that I am pointing out. There are more. Seek them out. Find them. The last characteristic is found at the end of verse 26. And in her tongue is the law of kindness. She's kind. You see, Dan, that is so simple. I want something complicated. I want a good psychoanalytical list of things that I need to do. No. Here it is. Loyalty. A good work ethic, generous, wise, kind. You say, Dan, are you trying to tell me that Ruth overcame her bad background simply by being that way? Turn to Ruth. Absolutely. Look at Ruth 1, 16 to 17. I will go. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where you die, I'll die. What does that sound like? Loyalty. Look at chapter 2, verses 2 to 7. We'll just read verse 2. And Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, let me go now to the field and glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. What does that sound like? A good work ethic. I personally would not like to go today and glean in that field across the street, would you? And yet she goes. She's hardworking. Look at chapter 2, verse 18. And she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. And she brought forth and gave to her that she had reserved after she was sufficed. This is generosity. Of course, there's the whole thing with her traveling with Naomi to begin with is generous. That's going the extra mile. But then she makes sure that she has food for her mother-in-law. Look at chapter 3, 5 and 6. She said unto her, all that thou sayest unto me, I will do. And she went down unto the floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law bade her. That definitely involves wisdom. One of the chief characteristics of the young is that they're bullheaded and they won't listen to older people. That's a foolish person. This woman was wise enough to see
the wisdom in what Naomi said, and she went and she did it. And lastly, chapter 3, verse 10, what does he say about her? He says, "For thou hast showed more kindness." She is kind. See, this woman was virtuous. Surely thou art a virtuous woman, and everybody in Bethlehem knows Ruth. So I don't think I'm going to have a problem when I go into the gate and I try to marry you, even though you're a Moabite. I don't think I'm going to have a problem. You know, one of the most interesting stories in missionary history is that of Mary Slessor. You've probably all heard about her. Back in the 19th century, a Scottish woman who grew up with seven kids. She was the second oldest of the seven. Her dad was a drunkard and a fool. He would throw his dinner into the fire while his children starved at his feet. Four of those children died, probably as a direct result of that wicked man. He died an early death, and Mary had to go work in the textile mill, just like David Livingstone, to try to support her family. And she could have given up, but she started kids' clubs. And she went out and ministered to the kids in the city. And she was faithful for years. And then almost miraculously, the opportunity arose to go to Calabar in Africa. And the rest is history, in the sense that I'm reading it and I'm admiring her for being a virtuous woman. And look at her background. Look at her family. What hope did she have? About as much as Ruth. About as much as you. If you're here today as a woman who thinks she can never get past her past, you take a heroine like Ruth, a hero there, and you get hope from that. And that brings me then to this. We're almost done. Men, are you taking care of your virtuous woman? You know, in Proverbs 31, it gives all those wonderful characteristics, but I want to tell you, maybe you're not aware of it, there is a passage in Isaiah that describes the kind of woman that you don't have. Turn to Isaiah 3. I really want to encourage you guys to turn here because of the imagery here. Isaiah 3:16 is the Lord, through Isaiah, indicting the ladies of his time. Of course, Isaiah lived through multiple kings and so on, but let's just read some of these verses. Men, I hope your wife isn't like this. Verse 16, "Moreover, the Lord saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go and making a tinkling with their feet. Therefore," it says in verse 17, "the Lord is going to smite them." Verse 18, "In that day the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet." Now, before I continue to read, this is very old English. Try not to giggle at the description. It's a little strange because the English is so old. Try to catch the severity of it. All right? Try not to giggle. "And their calls and their round tires like the moon." Verse 19, "the chains and the bracelets and the mufflers." Verse 20, "the bonnets and the ornaments of the legs and the headbands and the tablets and the earrings." Verse 21, "the rings and the nose jewels." Verse 22, "the changeable suits of apparel and the mantles and the wimples and the crisping pins, the glasses," that's mirrors, "and the fine linen and the hoods and the veils." Verse 24, "and it shall come to pass that instead of sweet smell there shall be stink, and instead of a girdle a rent, and instead of well-set hair baldness, and instead of a stomacher a girding of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty." You say, wow, that's a lot of weird words there, but let's just boil this down. What does it say they are like in verse 16? "The daughters of Zion are haughty. They walk with their necks stretched out and their eyes looking at other men, their wanton eyes, and their focus, evidently, is only on their appearance," because how many descriptive words do we have here? Whether it's crisping pins or stomachers or all the old English.
You can get the idea that they are walking along and they have ornaments on their feet so that they'll make a noise so that men will look at them. I simply bring this up as a contrast because it is one of the Old Testament passages that deal with the kind of woman that Ruth was not. These ladies were haughty and proud and shallow and vain. Men, if you're here today and you have on your arm a virtuous woman, when was the last time you told her that? When was the last time you bought her a rose and said, "You know what? I'm so glad that you don't have crisping pins." Seriously. When was the last time you went out on a date with her? You say, "Dan, why is this such a big deal?" Guys, Proverbs 31, 28. What does it say? I wish I could have all of us stand up as guys and read it. I'm amazed the ladies aren't saying amen. If this was a Baptist church, they would definitely be saying it. Men, turn back to Proverbs 31. Look down at verse 28. Her children arise up, and they call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. He praises her. When was the last time, men, that you praised your wife? Because she was generous, hardworking, kind, wise. Seriously, when was the last time? Not just praise, but verse 31. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. When was the last time you allowed her to enjoy some of the benefits of her hard work? You know, we in fundamental evangelical churches sometimes get the idea that the lady has to stay at home, and I've been guilty of it, and just sit there all day and work. Or if your wife is out in the workforce working hard day after day. I've known men that they work out their budget. I read a funny story once. Larry Burkett told it. He had a couple. He was counseling them about their finances. He said, "You got to get a budget. But whenever you work out a budget," Larry Burkett always said, "you should have a little mad money. That is, you should have a line category that you just spend however you want. Should be a certain amount. If you just want to go buy ice cream, if you want to buy whatever, just have that so that when you have that itch to spend a little money, you have that category." The couple comes back. They put out their stuff. He's looking through it. The wife says, "You know, I really appreciate what you said about mad money, but I'm a little concerned that my husband hasn't really, he hasn't given me very much." And the guy goes, "I gave you 50 cents a day for a Coke. That's how much you gave her." And Larry Burkett looked at it and said, "Wait a minute, you gave yourself $300 for new fishing poles. What is that?" Folks, it's biblical. Verse 31, give her of the fruit of her hands. Let her use the resources. You say, "Dan, I'm scared because I know how she shops." Well, that's a different issue. That's a different issue. The point I'm making is that we have a lot of virtuous ladies in this church. And I myself am very guilty at times of just taking my wife for granted. Men, don't do it. We've got a lot of ladies that are going to be working hard this week in Vacation Bible School. Maybe some of those ladies should get a Coke at the end of the week. A little bit more than a Coke. Because when it comes right down to it, Ruth is an example of our virtuous lady here. She was married to uncontrollable circumstances and suffering. She could not possibly have known that she would have been childless after 10 years and a widow. But her, through her virtue, God used her integrity and gave her a name, a husband, and a family, and a book in the Bible. One day, you and I are going to stand in her presence, and we're going to say, "Ruth, you're cool.
I read about you in church. I love your story. Let's go to God right now in prayer.